Part 9. Think Tank.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 24. This afternoon, I had another summons from Commander Judd, brought to me in person by a junior eye. Commander Judd could have picked up the phone himself and discussed his business that way. There was an internal hotline between his office and mine, with a red telephone, but, like me, he can't be sure who else might be listening. In addition, I believe he enjoys our little tete-a-tetes, for reasons that are complex and perverse. He thinks of me as his handiwork. I am the embodiment of his will. "I trust you are well, Aunt Lydia," he said as I sat down across from him. "Flourishing, praise be. And you?" "I myself am in good health, but I fear my wife is ailing. It weighs upon my soul." I was not surprised. The last time I saw her, Judd's current wife was looking shopworn. "That is sad news," I said. "What seems to be the malady?" "It is not clear," he said. "It never is. An affliction of the inner organs. Would you like someone at our calm and bomb clinic to consult?" "Perhaps not just yet," he said. "Most likely it is minor, or perhaps even imaginary, as so many of these female complaints prove to be." There was a pause while we regarded each other. Soon, I feared, he would again be a widower and in the market for another child bride. "Whatever I can do to help," I said. "Thank you, Aunt Lydia. You understand me so well," he said, smiling. "But that isn't the reason I asked you here. We have taken a position on the death of the Pearl Girl we lost in Canada." "What in fact transpired?" I already knew the answer, but had no intention of sharing it. "The official Canadian account of the matter is suicide," he said. "I am devastated to hear this," I replied. "Aunt Adriana was one of the most faithful and efficient. I placed much trust in her. She was exceptionally courageous. Our version is that the Canadians are covering up, and the depraved May Day terrorists, enabled by Canada's lax toleration of their illegal presence, killed Aunt Adriana. Though between you and me, we are baffled. Who can tell? It may even have been one of those random drug-related killings so prevalent in that decadent society. Aunt Sally was just around the corner purchasing some eggs. When she returned and discovered the tragedy, she wisely decided that a swift return to Gilead was her best option." "Very wisely," I said. "Upon her sudden return, a shaken Aunt Sally had come straight to me. Then she described how Adriana had met her end. She attacked me, out of nowhere, just before we were leaving for the consulate. I don't know why. She leapt on me and tried to choke me, and I fought back. It was self-defense," she'd sobbed. "A momentary psychotic break," I'd said. "The strain of being in a strange and debilitating environment such as Canada can have that effect. You did the right thing. You had no choice. I see no reason for anyone else to know about this. Do you?"
"Oh, thank you, Aunt Lydia. I'm so sorry it happened."
"Pray for Adriana's soul, then put it out of your mind," I'd said. "Do you have anything else to tell me?"
"Well, you asked us to be on the lookout for baby Nicole. The couple running the clothes hound had a daughter who would be about the right age."
"That is an interesting speculation," I'd said. "You intended to send a report via the consulate, instead of waiting to speak directly with me upon return?"
"Well, I thought you should know immediately. Aunt Adriana said it would be premature. She was strongly against it. We had words about it. I insisted that it was important," Aunt Sally had said defensively.
"Indeed," I said, "it was. But risky. Such a report might well have started an unfounded rumor with dire consequences. We have had so many false alarms, and everyone in the consulate is potentially an eye. The eyes can be so blunt, they lack finesse.
There is always a reason for my instructions, my orders. It is not for the Pearl Girls to take unauthorized initiatives.
Oh, I didn't realize, I didn't think. But still, Aunt Adriana shouldn't have...
He said, soonest mended. I know you meant well, I told her soothingly. Aunt Sally had started to cry.
I did. I really did.
Hell was paved with good intentions, I'd been tempted to say, but refrained. Where is the girl in question now? I'd asked. She must have gone somewhere after her parents were removed from the scene.
I don't know.
Maybe they shouldn't have blown up the clothes hound so soon. Then we would have been able to... I concur. I did advise against hastiness. Unfortunately, the agents run by the eyes in Canada are young and enthusiastic, and they do admire explosions.
But how were they to know?
I'd paused, fixed her with my best penetrating gaze. And you have not communicated your suspicions about this potential baby Nicole to anyone else?
No. Only to you, Aunt Lydia, and to Aunt Adriana before she...
Let's keep this to ourselves, shall we? I'd said. There need not be a trial. Now, I think you need some rest and recuperation. I'll arrange a stay for you at our lovely Marjorie Kemp retreat house in Walden. You'll be a different woman soon. The car will take you there in half an hour. And if Canada agitates about the unfortunate condo occurrence, if they wish to interview you or even charge you with some crime, we'll simply say you have disappeared. I did not wish Aunt Sally dead. I simply wished her incoherent. And so it has been. The Marjorie Kemp retreat house has a discreet staff. More tearful thanks from Aunt Sally. Don't thank me, I'd said. It is I who should be thanking you. Aunt Adriana did not give her life in vain, Commander Judd was saying. Your Pearl Girl set us on a profitable course of action. We have made yet other discoveries. My heart contracted. I'm happy that my girls were of use. As always, thank you for your initiative. Since our operation involving the used clothing store indicated by your Pearl Girls, we've become certain of the means by which information has been exchanged in recent years between Mayday and their unknown contact here in Gilead. And what is that means? Via the burglary, via the special operation, we recovered a microdot camera. We've been doing tests with it. Microdot, I asked, what is that? An old technology that has fallen into disuse, but that is still perfectly viable. Documents are photographed with a miniature camera that reduces them to microscopic size. Then they are printed on minute plastic dots, which can be applied to almost any surface and read by the recipient with a custom viewer small enough to be concealed in, for instance, a pen. Astonishing, I exclaimed. Not for nothing do we at Ardua Hall say pen is envy. He laughed. Indeed, he said. We pen wielders must take care to avoid reproach. But it is intelligent of Mayday to have resorted to this method. Not many people today would be aware of it. As they say, if you aren't looking, you don't see. Ingenious, I said. It's only one end of the string, the Mayday end. As I've mentioned, there's a Gilead end, those who are receiving the microdots here and reciprocating with messages of their own. We have still not identified that individual or individuals. I've asked my colleagues at Ardua Hall to keep their eyes and ears open, I said. And who better placed to do that than the aunts, he said. You have access to any house you choose to enter, and with your finer women's intuition, you hear things we dull men are too deaf to register. We'll outfox Mayday yet, I said, clenching my fists, thrusting out my jaw. I like your spirit, Aunt Lydia, he said, we make a great team. The truth shall prevail, I said.
I was quivering with what I hoped would pass as righteous indignation.
Under his eye, he replied.
After this, my reader, I was in need of a restorative. I made my way to the Schlafly Café for a cup of hot milk. Then I came here, to the Hildegard Library, to continue my journey with you. Think of me as a guide. Think of yourself as a wanderer in a dark wood. It's about to get darker. On the last page where we met, I'd brought you as far as the stadium, and there I will resume. As time crept by, things fell into a pattern. Sleep at night if you could. Endure the days. Hug the weepers. Though I have to say the weeping became tedious. So did the howling. There was an attempt at music on the first evenings. A couple of the more optimistic and energetic women styled themselves sing-song leaders, and attempted versions of We Shall Overcome, and similar archaic chestnuts recalled from vanished summer camp experiences. There were problems remembering the words, but at least it added variety. No guards put a stop to these efforts. However, by day three, the perkiness was fading, and few were joining in, and there were mutterings, "Quiet, please, for God's sake, shut up." So the Girl Scout leaders, after a few hurt protests, "I was only trying to help," ceased and desisted. I was not one of the singers. Why waste your energy? My mood was not melodious. It was rather one of a rat in a maze. Was there a way out? What was that way? Why was I here? Was it a test? What were they trying to find out? Some women had nightmares, as you'd assume. They would groan and thrash about during them, or sit bolt upright with modified shouts. I'm not criticizing. I had nightmares myself. Shall I describe one for you? No, I will not. I'm fully aware of how easily one can become fatigued by other people's nightmares, having heard a number of recitals of these by now. When push comes to shove, only one's own nightmares are of any interest or significance. In the mornings, wake-up was perpetrated by a siren. Those whose watches had not been taken away, watch removal had been spotty, reported that this happened at 6 a.m. Bread and water for breakfast. How superlatively good that bread tasted. Some wolfed and guzzled, but I made my portion last as long as possible. Chewing and swallowing distracts from abstract mental wheel-spinning. Also, it passes the time. Then, lineups for the foul toilets, and good luck to you if yours was clogged, since no one would come to unclog it. My theory? The guards went around at night stuffing various materials down the toilets as a further aggravation. Some of the more tidy-minded tried to clean up the washrooms, but once they saw how hopeless it was, they gave up. Giving up was the new normal, and I have to say it was catching. Did I say there was no toilet paper? What then? Use your hand. Attempt to clean your sullied fingers under the dribble of water that sometimes came out of the taps and sometimes did not. I'm sure they arranged that on purpose also, to raise us up and hurl us down at random intervals. I could picture the glee on the face of whatever kitten-torturing cretin was assigned this task as he flipped the power switch on the water flow system back and forth. We had been told not to drink the water from those taps, but some unwisely did. Retching and diarrhea followed to contribute to the general joy. There were no paper towels. There were no towels of any kind. We wiped our hands on our skirts, whether those hands had been washed or not. I am sorry to dwell so much on the facilities, but you would be amazed at how important such things become. Basics that you've taken for granted, that you've barely thought about until they're removed from you. During my daydreams, and we all daydreamed,
as enforced stasis with no events produces daydreams, and the brain must busy itself with something, I frequently pictured a beautiful, clean, white toilet. Oh, and a sink to go with it, with an ample flow of pure, clear water. Naturally, we began to stink. In addition to the ordeal by toilet, we'd been sleeping in our business attire, with no change of underwear. Some of us were past menopause, but others were not, so the smell of clotting blood was added to the sweat and tears and shit and puke. To breathe was to be nauseated. They were reducing us to animals, to penned-up animals, to our animal nature. They were rubbing our noses in that nature. We were to consider ourselves subhuman. The rest of each day would unfurl like a toxic flower, petal by petal, agonizingly slow. We were sometimes handcuffed again, though sometimes not, then marched out in a line and slotted into the bleachers to sit under the blazing sun, and on one occasion, blissfully, in a cool drizzle. We reeked of wet clothing that night, but less of ourselves. Hour by hour we watched vans arrive, discharge their quota of women, depart empty. The same wailings from the new arrivals, the same barking and shouts from the guards. How tedious is a tyranny in the throes of enactment. It's always the same plot. Lunch was the sandwiches again, and on one day, the drizzle day, some carrot sticks. Nothing like a balanced meal, said Anita. We had contrived to sit next to each other most days, and to sleep in proximity. She had not been a personal friend before this time, merely a professional colleague, but it gave me comfort simply to be with someone I knew, someone who personified my previous achievements, my previous life. You might say we bonded. You were a damn fine judge, she whispered to me on the third day. Thank you. So were you, I whispered back. Were was chilling. Of the others in our section, I learned little. Their names sometimes, the names of their firms. Some firms had specialized in domestic work, divorces, child custody, and so forth. So if women were now the enemy, I could see why they might have been targeted. But being in real estate or litigation or estate law or corporate law appeared to offer no protection. All that was necessary was a law degree and a uterus, a lethal combination. The afternoons were chosen for the executions, the same parade out to the middle of the field with the blinded, condemned ones. I noticed more details as time went on, how some could hardly walk, how some seemed barely conscious. What had been happening to them, and why had they been selected to die? The same man in a black uniform exhorting into a microphone, God will prevail! Then the shots, the toppling, the limp bodies. Then the cleanup. There was a truck for the corpses. Were they buried? Were they burned? Or was that too much trouble? Perhaps they were simply taken to a dump site and left for crows. On the fourth day, there was a variation. Three of the shooters were women. They weren't in business suits, but in long, brown garments like bathrobes, with scarves tied under their chins. That got our attention. Monsters, I whispered to Anita. How could they? She whispered back. On the fifth day, there were six women in brown among the shooters. There was also an uproar as one of them, instead of aiming at the blindfolded ones, pivoted and shot one of the men in black uniforms. She was immediately bludgeoned to the ground and riddled with bullets. There was a collective gasp from the bleachers. So, I thought, that's one way out. During the days, new women would be added to our group of lawyers and judges. It stayed the same size, however, since every night some were removed. They left singly, between two guards. We did not know where they were being taken or why. None came back. On the sixth night, Anita was spirited away. It happened very quietly. Sometimes the targeted ones would shout and resist, but Anita did not, and I am ashamed to say that I was asleep when she was deleted. I woke up when the morning siren went off and she was simply not there. "I'm sorry about your friend," one kind soul whispered to me as we stood in line for the pullulating toilets. "I'm sorry, too," I whispered back. But I was already hardening myself for what was almost surely to come. "Sorry solves nothing," I told myself. Over the years, the many years, how true I have found that to be. On the seventh night, it was me. Anita had been noiselessly abstracted. That silence had had a demoralizing effect all its own. Since one could vanish, it seemed, with nobody noticing, and not even a ripple of sound. But it was not intended that I should go quietly. I was wakened by a boot applied to the hip. "Shut up and get up," said one of the barking voices. Before I was properly awake, I was being yanked upright and set in motion. All around there were murmurs, and one voice said, "No," and another said, "Fuck," and another said, "God bless," and another said, "Cuídate mucho." "I can walk by myself," I said, but this made no difference to the hands on my upper arms, one on either side. "This is it," I thought. "They're going to shoot me." But no, I corrected myself. "That's an afternoon thing." "Idiot," I countered. "Shooting can happen anywhere at any time, and anyway, shooting is not the only method." All this time I was quite calm, which seems hard to believe. And in fact, I no longer believe it. I was not quite calm. I was dead calm. As long as I thought of myself as already dead, untroubled by future cares, things would go easier for me. I was steered through the corridors, then out of a back entrance and into a car. It was not a van this time, but a Volvo. The back seat upholstery was soft but firm. The air conditioning was like a breath of paradise. Unfortunately, the freshness of the air reminded me of my own accumulated odors. Nevertheless, I relished the luxury, despite the fact that I was squashed in between my two guards, both of them bulky. Neither said anything. I was simply a bundle to be transported. The car stopped outside a police station. It was no longer a police station, however. The lettering had been covered over, and on the front door there was an image. An eye. With wings. The logo of the eyes, though I did not yet know that. Up the front steps we went, my two companions striding, me stumbling. My feet hurt. I realized how out of practice they had become, and also how wrecked and filthy my shoes were, after the drenching, the baking, and the various substances to which they had been subjected. We went along the corridor. Baritone rumblings came from behind doors. Men in outfits like the ones beside me hurried past, their eyes gleaming with purpose, their voices staccato. There's something spine-stiffening about uniforms, about insignia, about shiny lapel pins. "No slouchers here." We turned into one of the rooms. There, behind a large desk, sat a man who looked faintly like Santa Claus. Plump, white beard, rosy cheeks, cherry nose. He beamed at me. "You may sit down," he said. "Thank you," I replied. Not that I had a choice. My two travel buddies were inserting me into a chair and attaching me to it with plastic straps, arms to arms. Then they left the room, closing the door softly behind them. I had the impression that they went out backwards, as if in the presence of some ancient god-king, but I couldn't see behind me. "I should introduce myself," he said. "I am Commander Judd of the Sons of Jacob." This was our first meeting. "I suppose you know who I am," I replied. "That is correct," he said, smiling blandly. I apologize for the inconveniences you have been exposed to.
It was nothing, I said, straight-faced. It's foolish to joke with those who have absolute control over you. They don't like it. They think you don't appreciate the full extent of their power. Now that I have power myself, I do not encourage flippancy among subordinates. But I was careless back then. I have learned better. His smile vanished.
Are you thankful to be alive? He said.
Well, yes, I said.
Are you thankful that God made you in a woman's body?
I suppose so, I said. I've never thought about it.
I am not sure you are thankful enough, he said.
What would thankful enough be like, I said.
Thankful enough to cooperate with us, he said.
Have I mentioned that he had little oblong half-glasses? He took these off now and contemplated them. His eyes without the glasses were less twinkly. What do you mean by cooperate, I said. It's a yes or a no. I was trained as a lawyer, I said. I'm a judge. I don't sign blank contracts.
You are not a judge, he said, anymore.
He pressed a button on an intercom.
Thank Tank, he said.
Then to me, let us hope you will learn to be more thankful. I will pray for that result. And that is how I found myself in the Thank Tank. It was a repurposed police station isolation cell, approximately 4 paces by 4. It had a bed shelf, though there was no mattress. It had a bucket, which I swiftly concluded was for human food byproducts, as there were still some of those in it, as witnessed by the smell. It had once had a light, but no more. Now it had only a socket, and this was not live. Of course, I stuck my finger into it after a while. You would have too. Any light I had would come from the corridor outside, through the slot by which the inevitable sandwiches would shortly arrive. Gnawing in the dark, that was the plan for me. I groped around in the dusk, found the bed slab, sat down on it. I can do this, I thought. I can get through. I was right, but only just. You'd be surprised how quickly the mind goes soggy in the absence of other people. One person alone is not a full person. We exist in relation to others. I was one person. I risked becoming no person. I was in the Thank Tank for some time, I don't know how long. Every once in a while, an eye would view me through the sliding shutter that was there for viewing purposes. Every once in a while, there would be a scream or a series of shrieks from nearby. Brutalization on parade. Sometimes there would be a prolonged moaning. Sometimes a series of grunts and breathy gasps that sounded sexual, and probably were. The powerless are so tempting. I had no way of knowing whether or not these noises were real or merely recordings, intended to shatter my nerves and wear away my resolve. Whatever my resolve might be, after some days I lost track of that plot line. The plot line of my resolve. I was parked inside my twilight cell for an unknown length of time. But it couldn't really have been that long, judging from the length of my fingernails when I was brought out of it. Time, however, is different when you're shut up in the dark alone. It's longer. Nor do you know when you're asleep and when awake. Were there insects? Yes, there were insects. They did not bite me, so I expect they were cockroaches. I could feel their tiny feet tiptoeing across my face, tenderly, tentatively, as if my skin were thin ice. I did not slap them. After a while, you welcome any kind of touch. One day, if it was a day, 3 men came into my cell without warning, shone a glaring light into my blinking, purblind eyes, threw me onto the floor, and administered a precise kicking and other attentions. The noises I emitted were familiar to me. I had heard them nearby,
I won't go into any further details except to say that tasers were also involved. No, I was not raped. I suppose I was already too old and tough for the purpose. Or it may be that they were priding themselves on their high moral standards, but I doubt this very much. This kicking and tasing procedure was repeated 2 more times. 3 is a magic number. Did I weep? Yes. Tears came out of my 2 visible eyes, my moist, weeping human eyes. But I had a 3rd eye in the middle of my forehead. I could feel it. It was cold, like a stone. It did not weep. It saw. And behind it, someone was thinking, I will get you back for this. I don't care how long it takes or how much shit I have to eat in the meantime, but I will do it. Then, after an indefinite period and without warning, the door to my think tank cell clanged open. Light flooded in, and 2 black uniforms hauled me out. No words were spoken. I, by this time a shambling wreck, and even smellier than before, was marched or dragged down the corridor by which I had arrived, and out the front door by which I had entered, and into an air-conditioned van. Next thing I knew, I was in a hotel. Yes, a hotel. It was not one of the grand hotels, more like a Holiday Inn, if that name will mean anything to you, though I suppose it will not. Where are the brands of yesteryear? Gone with the wind. Or rather, gone with the paintbrush and the demolition team, because as I was being hauled into the lobby, there were workmen overhead, obliterating the lettering. In the lobby, there was no sweetly smiling reception staff to welcome me. Instead, there was a man with a list. A conversation took place between him and my 2 tour guides, and I was propelled into an elevator, then along a carpeted corridor that was only beginning to show signs of an absence of maids. A couple more months, and they'll have a serious mildew issue, I thought, with my mushy brain, as a door was carted open. Enjoy your stay, said one of my minders. I don't believe he was being ironic. 3 days R&R, said the second one. Anything you need, phone the front desk. The door locked behind them. On the small table there was a tray with orange juice and a banana and a green salad and a serving of poached salmon, a bed with sheets, several towels, more or less white, a shower. Above all, a beautiful ceramic toilet. I fell to my knees and uttered, yes, a heartfelt prayer, but to whom or what, I could not tell you. After I'd eaten all the food, I didn't care if it was poisoned. I was so overjoyed by it, I spent the next few hours taking showers. Just 1 shower was not enough. There were so many layers of accumulated grime I had to wash off. I inspected my healing abrasions, my yellowing and purpling bruises. I'd lost weight. I could see my ribs, which had reappeared after a decades-long absence due to fast-food lunches. During my legal career, my body had been merely a vehicle for propelling me from one achievement to the next, but now I had a newfound tenderness for it. How pink were my toenails? How intricate the vein patterns on my hands. I could not get a good fix on my face in the bathroom mirror, however. Who was that person? The features seemed blurred. Then I slept for a long time. When I woke up, there was another delicious meal, beef stroganoff with a side of asparagus, and peach melba for dessert, and, oh, joy, a cup of coffee. I would have liked a martini, but I guessed that alcohol was not going to be on the women's menu in this new era. My stinking former clothes had been removed by unseen hands. It seemed I was to live in the white terry cloth hotel bathrobe. I was still in a state of mental disarray. I was a jigsaw puzzle thrown onto the floor. But on the 3rd morning, or was it an afternoon, I woke in an improved state of coherence.
It seemed I could think again. It seemed I could think the word I. In addition to that, and as if in acknowledgement of it, there was a fresh garment laid out for me. It was not quite a cowl, and it was not quite made of brown sackcloth, but close. I had seen it before, in the stadium, worn by the female shooters. I felt a chill. I put it on. What else should I have done?
Part 10. Spring Green.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 25. I will now describe the preparations leading up to my proposed marriage, as there has been some interest expressed in the way such things were conducted in Gilead. Due to the twist my life took, I was able to observe the marriage process from both sides, that of the bride being prepared, and that of the aunts responsible for the preparing. The arrangement of my own wedding was standard. The temperaments of the parties involved, as well as their respective positions in Gilead society, were supposed to have some influence on the choices made available. But the goal in every instance was the same. Girls of all kinds, those from good families as well as the less favored, were to be married early, before any chance encounter with an unsuitable man might occur that would lead to what used to be called falling in love, or worse, to loss of virginity. This latter disgrace was to be avoided at all costs, as the consequences could be severe. Death by stoning was not a fate anyone wanted for their children, and the stain of it on a family could be next to indelible. One evening, Paula called me into the living room. She'd sent Rosa to pry me out of my shell, as she put it, and told me to stand in front of her. I did as required, as there was no point in not doing it. Commander Kyle was there, and so was Aunt Vidala. There was another aunt there as well, one I had never seen, who was introduced to me as Aunt Gabbana. I said I was pleased to meet her, but I must have said it in a surly voice because Paula said, "You see what I mean?" "It is her age," said Aunt Gabbana. "Even formerly sweet and tractable girls go through this stage." "She's certainly old enough," said Aunt Vidala. "We have taught her all we can. If they stay in school too long, they become disruptive." "She's truly a woman?" said Aunt Gabbana, eyeing me shrewdly. "Of course," said Paula. "None of that's padding," said Aunt Gabbana, nodding towards my chest. "Certainly not," said Paula. "You'd be amazed at what some families try. She has nice wide hips, none of these narrow pelvises. Let me see your teeth, Agnes." How was I supposed to do that? Open my mouth wide as at the dentist? Paula saw I was confused. "Smile," she said, "for once." I drew back my lips in a grimace. "Perfect teeth," said Aunt Gabbana. "Very healthy. Well then, we will start looking." "Only among the commander families," said Paula. "Nothing lower." "That is understood," said Aunt Gabbana. She was making some notations on a clipboard. I watched in awe as she moved her fingers, which held a pencil. What potent symbols was she inscribing?
"She's a little young," said Commander Kyle, whom I no longer thought of as my father. "Possibly." I was grateful to him for the first time in a long while.
13 is not too young. It all depends," said Aunt Gabbana. "It does wonders for them if we can find the proper match. They settle right down." She stood. "Don't worry, Agnes," she said to me. "You'll have a choice among at least 3 candidates. They will consider it an honor," she said to Commander Kyle. "Let us know if there's anything else you need,"
said Paula, graciously. And sooner is better.
Understood, said Aunt Gabbana.
There will be the usual donation to Ardua Hall once there are satisfactory results?
Of course, said Paula. We'll pray for your success. May the Lord open.
Under his eye, said Aunt Gabbana. The two aunts left, exchanging smiles and nods with my non-parents.
You may go, Agnes, said Paula. We'll keep you informed as matters develop. Entering into the blessed state of married womanhood must be done with every precaution, and your father and I will take those precautions for you. You are a very privileged girl. I hope you appreciate that. She gave me a malicious little smirk. She knew she was talking froth. In reality, I was an inconvenient lump that had to be disposed of in a socially acceptable manner. I went back up to my room. I should have seen this coming. Such things had happened to girls who had not been much older than me. A girl would be present at school and then one day not present. The aunts didn't like a lot of fuss and sentiment with tearful goodbyes. Then there would be rumors of an engagement. Then of a wedding. We were never allowed to go to these weddings, even if the girl had been our close friend. When you were being readied for marriage, you disappeared from your former life. The next time you were seen, you'd be wearing the dignified blue dress of a wife, and unmarried girls would have to let you go first through doorways. This was now going to be my reality. I was to be ejected from my own house, from Tabitha's house, from the house of Zillah and Vera and Rosa, because Paula had had enough of me. You won't go to school today, said Paula one morning, and that was that. Then nothing much happened for a week, except some moping and fretting on my part. Though, since I pursued these activities alone in my room, they had no influence. I was supposed to be finishing a hateful petty point project to keep my mind occupied. The design was a bowl of fruit suitable for being made into a footstool, intended for my future husband, whoever he might be. In one corner of the footstool square, I embroidered a small skull. It represented the skull of my stepmother, Paula. But if anyone asked me about it, I planned to say that it was a memento mori, a reminder of the fact that we must all die someday. This could hardly be objected to, as it was a pious motif. There were skulls like that on the gravestones of the old churchyard near our school. We were not supposed to go in there except to attend funerals. The names of the dead were on the stones, and that might lead to reading, and then to depravity. Reading was not for girls. Only men were strong enough to deal with the force of it, and the aunts, of course, because they weren't like us. I had begun to wonder how a woman changed into an aunt. Aunt Este had said once that you needed to have a calling that told you God wanted you to help all women, and not just a single family. But how did the aunts get that calling? How had they received their strength? Did they have special brains, neither female nor male? Were they even women at all underneath their uniforms? Could they possibly be men in disguise? Even to suspect such a thing was unthinkable. But what a scandal if so. I wondered what the aunts would look like if you made them wear pink. On the third day of my idleness, Paula had the Marthas bring several cardboard boxes to my room. It was time to put away childish things, she said. My belongings could go into storage as very soon I would not be living here anymore. Then, once I was ordering my new household, I could decide which of these belongings should be donated to the poor.
A less privileged girl from an Econo family would take great joy in my old dollhouse, for instance. Although it was not top quality and was in a shoddy state, some paint here and there would do wonders. The dollhouse had stood near my window for many years. The happy hours I'd spent with Tabitha were still contained within it. There was the wife doll, sitting at the dining table. There were the little girls behaving themselves. There were the Marthas in the kitchen making bread. There was the commander, safely locked into his study. After Paula had left, I plucked the wife doll out of her chair and threw her across the room. Chapter 26. The next thing Aunt Gabbana did was to bring in a wardrobe team, as Paula put it. Since I was considered incapable of choosing what I was to wear in the time leading up to my wedding, and especially at the wedding itself. You must understand that I was not anybody in my own right. Although of the privileged class, I was just a young girl about to be confined to wedlock. Wedlock. It had a dull metallic sound, like an iron door clicking shut. The wardrobe team was in charge of what you might call the stage set, the costumes, the refreshments, the decor. None of them had a dominating personality, which was why they had been relegated to these relatively menial duties. So even though all aunts had high status, Paula, who did have a dominating personality, was able to boss the wedding brigade aunts around, within limits. The three of them came up to my bedroom, Paula accompanying them, where, having finished my footstool project, I was amusing myself as best as I could by playing solitaire. The deck I used was normal in Gilead, but in case this deck is not known to the outside world, I will describe it. Naturally, there were not any letters on the ace, king, queen, or jack cards, nor were there any numbers on the number cards. The aces were a large eye looking out of a cloud. Kings wore commander uniforms, queens were wives, and jacks were aunts. The face cards were the most powerful cards. Of the suits, spades were angels, clubs were guardians, diamonds were Marthas, and hearts were handmaids. Each face card had a border of smaller figures. A wife of angels would have a blue wife with a border of small black-clad angels. And a commander of handmaids would have a border of tiny handmaids. Later, once I had access to the Ardua Hall library, I researched these cards. Far back in history, hearts were once chalices. Perhaps that is why the handmaids were hearts. They were precious containers. The three wardrobe team aunts advanced into my room. Paula said, "Put your game away and stand up, please, Agnes," in her sweetest voice, the voice of hers that I disliked the most because I knew how fraudulent it was. I did as I was told, and the three aunts were introduced. Aunt Lorna, plump-faced and smiling, Aunt Sara Lee, stoop-shouldered and taciturn, and Aunt Betty, dithery and apologetic. "They're here for a fitting," Paula said. "What?" I said. Nobody ever alerted me about anything. They did not see the need for it.
"Don't say what. Say pardon," said Paula. "A fitting for the clothes you will be wearing to your premarital preparatory classes."
Paula ordered me to take off my pink school uniform, which I was still wearing since I didn't have any other kinds of clothes, apart from my white dress for church. I stood in the middle of the room in my slip. The air wasn't cold, but I could feel the goosebumps rising on my skin from being looked at and considered. Aunt Lorna took my measurements, and Aunt Betty wrote them down in a small notebook.
I watched her carefully. I always watched the aunts when they were writing secret messages to themselves. Then I was told I could put my uniform back on, which I did. There was a discussion about whether I would need new underclothing for the interim period. Aunt Lorna thought it would be nice, but Paula said it was unnecessary because the time in question would be short and what I had still fit me. Paula won. Then the three aunts went away. They came back several days later with two outfits, one for spring and summer, and one for fall and winter. They were themed in green, spring green with white accents, pocket trims, collars for spring and summer, and spring green with dark green accents for fall and winter. I'd seen girls my age wearing these dresses, and I knew what they meant. Spring green was for fresh leaves, so the girl was ready for marriage. Akano families were not allowed such extravagances, however. The clothes the aunts brought had already been worn, but they weren't worn out since nobody wore the green clothing for long. They'd been altered to fit me. The skirts were 5 inches above the ankle, the sleeves came to the wrist, the waists were loose, the collars high. Each had a matching hat, with a brim and a ribbon. I hated these outfits, though moderately. If I had to have clothes, these were not the worst. I found some hope in the fact that all the seasons had been provided for. Maybe I would make it all the way through fall and winter without having to get married. My old pink and plum clothes were taken away to be cleaned and reused for younger girls. Gilead was at war. We did not like to throw things out. Chapter 27. Once I had the green wardrobe, I was enrolled in another school, Ruby's Premarital Preparatory, a school for young women of good family who were studying to be married. Its motto was from the Bible. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. This school was also run by the aunts, but despite the fact that they wore the same drab uniforms, these aunts were somehow more stylish. They were supposed to teach us how to act as mistresses of high-ranking households. I say act in a dual sense. We were to be actresses on the stages of our future houses. Shunammite and Becca from the Vidala school were in the same class with me. Vidala school pupils often went on to Ruby's. Not much real time had passed since I'd last seen the two of them, but they seemed much older. Shunammite had coiled her dark braids around behind her head and plucked her eyebrows. You wouldn't have called her beautiful, but she was as lively as she always had been. I note here that lively was a word the wives used in a disapproving way. It meant brash. Shunammite said she was looking forward to being married. In fact, she could talk of nothing else. What sorts of husbands were being vetted for her? What kind she would prefer? How she could hardly wait. She wanted a widower of about 40, who hadn't loved his first wife all that much and had no children, and was high-ranking and handsome. She didn't want some young jerk who'd never had sex before because that would be uncomfortable. What if he didn't know where to put his thing? She'd always had a reckless mouth, but now it was more so. Possibly she'd picked up these new coarser expressions from a Martha. Becca was even thinner. Her green-brown eyes, always large in proportion to her face, were, if anything, even larger. She told me that she was glad to be in this class with me, but she was not glad to be in the class itself. She'd begged and begged her family not to marry her yet. She was too young. She wasn't ready. But they'd received a very good offer. The eldest boy of a son of Jacob and Commander, who was well on his way to becoming a commander himself. Her mother had told her not to be silly. She would never have an offer like this again. And if she didn't take this one, the offers would become worse and worse the older she became. If she reached 18 unmarried, she'd be considered dried goods and would be out of the running for commanders. She'd be lucky to get even a guardian. Her father, Dr. Grove, the dentist, said it was unusual for a commander to consider a girl of her lower rank, and it would be an insult to refuse. And did she wish to ruin him?
But I don't want to,
she would wail to us when Aunt Lee's was out of the room.
To have some man crawling all over you like worms, I hate it.
It occurred to me that she didn't say she would hate it. She said she already hated it. What had happened to her? Something disgraceful that she couldn't talk about? I remembered how upset she'd been by the story of the concubine cut into 12 pieces. But I didn't want to ask her. Another girl's disgrace could rub off on you if you got too close to it.
It won't hurt that much, said Shunammite. And think of all the things you'll have. Your own house, your own car and guardians, and your own Marthas. And if you can't have a baby, you'll be given handmaids, as many as it takes.
I don't care about cars and Marthas or even handmaids, said Becca. It's the horrible feeling, the wet feeling.
Like what? Said Shunammite, laughing. You mean their tongues? It's no worse than dogs.
It's much worse, said Becca. Dogs are friendly.
I didn't say anything about what I myself felt about getting married. I couldn't share the story of my dental appointment with Dr. Grove. He was still Becca's father, and Becca was still my friend. In any case, my reaction had been more like disgust and loathing, and now seemed to me trivial in view of Becca's genuine horror. She really did believe that marriage would obliterate her. She would be crushed. She would be nullified. She would be melted like snow until nothing remained of her. Away from Shunammite, I asked her why her mother wouldn't help her. Then there were tears. Her mother wasn't her real mother. She'd found that out from their Martha. It was shameful, but her real mother had been a handmaid.
Like yours, Agnes, she said.
Her official mother had used that fact against her. Why was she so afraid of having sex with a man, since her slut of a handmaid mother hadn't had such fears? Quite the contrary. I hugged her then and said I understood. Chapter 28. Aunt Lee's was supposed to teach us manners and customs, which fork to use, how to pour tea, how to be kind but firm with Martha's, and how to avoid emotional entanglements with our handmaid, should it turn out that we needed a handmaid. Everyone had a place in Gilead. Everyone served in her own way, and all were equal in the sight of God. But some had gifts that were different from the gifts of others, said Aunt Lee's. If the various gifts were confused and everyone tried to be everything, only chaos and harm could result. No one should expect a cow to be a bird. She taught us elementary gardening, with an emphasis on roses. Gardening was a suitable hobby for wives. And how to judge the quality of the food that was cooked for us and served at our table. In these times of national scarcity, it was important not to waste food or to spoil its full potential. Animals had died for us, Aunt Lee's reminded us. And vegetables too, she added in a virtuous tone. We needed to be thankful for this, and for God's bounty. It was as disrespectful, one might even say sinful, to divine providence to mistreat food by cooking it badly as it was to discard it uneaten. Therefore, we learned how to poach an egg properly, and at what temperature a quiche ought to be served, and the difference between a bisque and a potage. I can't say I remember much about these lessons now, as I never was in a position to put them into practice. She reviewed with us the proper prayers to say before meals, too. Our husbands would recite the prayers when they were present, as heads of the household, but when they were absent, as they would be often, since they would have to work late hours, nor should we ever criticize their lateness, then it would be our duty to say these prayers on behalf of what Aunt Lee's hoped would be our numerous children. Here, she gave a tight little smile. Through my head was running the pretend prayer that Shunammite and I used to amuse ourselves with when we were best friends at the Fadala school. Bless my overflowing cup, it flowed upon the floor. That's because I threw it up. Now, Lord, I'm back for more. The sound of our giggling receded into the distance. How badly we'd thought we were behaving then. How innocent and ineffectual these tiny rebellions seemed to me now that I was preparing for marriage. As the summer wore on, Aunt Lee's taught us the basics of interior decorating, though the final choices about the style of our homes would of course be made by our husbands. She then taught us flower arrangement, the Japanese style and the French style. By the time we got to the French style, Becca was deeply dejected. Her wedding was planned for November. The man selected for her had paid his first visit to her family. He'd been received in their living room and had made small talk with her father while she'd sat there silently. This was the protocol, and I would be expected to do the same. And she said he'd made her flesh crawl. He had pimples and a scraggly little mustache, and his tongue was white. Shunammite laughed and said it was probably toothpaste. He must have brushed his teeth just before coming because he wanted to make a good impression on her, and wasn't that sweet? But Becca said she wished she was ill. Severely ill with something not only prolonged but catching, because then any proposed wedding would have to be called off. On the fourth day of French-style flower arranging, when we were learning to do symmetrical formal vases with contrasting but complementary textures, Becca slashed her left wrist with the secateurs and had to be taken to the hospital. The cut wasn't fatally deep, but a lot of blood came out nonetheless. It ruined the white Shasta daisies. I'd been watching when she did it. I could not forget her expression. It had a ferocity I had never seen in her before and which I found very disturbing. It was as if she'd turned into a different person, a much wilder one, though only for a moment. By the time the paramedics had come and were taking her away, she'd looked serene. "Goodbye, Agnes," she'd said to me, but I hadn't known how to answer. "That girl is immature," said Aunt Lise. She wore her hair in a chignon, which was quite elegant. She looked at us sideways down her long patrician nose. "Unlike you girls," she added. Shunammite beamed. She was all set to be mature, and I managed a little smile. I thought I was learning how to act, or rather, how to be an actress, or how to be a better actress than before.
Part 11. Sackcloth.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 29. Last night I had a nightmare. I have had it before. Earlier in this account, I said that I would not try your patience with a recital of my dreams. But as this one has a bearing on what I am about to tell you, I will make an exception. You are, of course, fully in control of what you choose to read, and may pass over this dream of mine at will. I am standing in the stadium, wearing the brown dressing gown-like garment that was issued to me in the repurposed hotel during my recovery from the think tank. Standing in a line with me are several other women in the same penitential garb and several men in black uniforms. Each of us has a rifle. We know that some of these rifles contain blanks, some not. But we will all be killers nonetheless, because it's the thought that counts. Facing us are two rows of women, one standing, one kneeling. They are not wearing blindfolds. I can see their faces. I recognize them, each and every one. Former friends, former clients, former colleagues, and more recently, women and girls who have passed through my hands. Wives, daughters, handmaids. Some have missing fingers, some have one foot, some have one eye, some have ropes around their necks. I have judged them. I have passed sentence. Once a judge, always a judge. But they are all smiling. What do I see in their eyes? Fear? Contempt? Defiance? Pity? It's impossible to tell. Those of us with rifles raise them.